everyone, and welcome back to Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show whose sole purpose now is to stop me having a Brexit-related nervous breakdown. I'm Andrew Harrison, and as usual, I'm joined by Sean Pattenden, the merciless Lady Hale to my Lord Panic. Hello, Sean. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Pop music is finding it very hard to keep up with the constitutional politics or white-knuckle thrills right now, is it not?
Politics is the new rock and roll, as they don't say.
Politics is the new rock and roll. Well, you know, you get to stand in a crowd and shout at stuff.
Yeah, and it changes minute by minute.
It changes minute by minute. Yeah. We did see that Paul McCartney says he's against Brexit, though, so that's good.
Well, I would hope so. You would think that someone, you know, like him, would, amongst everything else, you know, be pro-Remain.
We did a Remainiacs live in London on Monday, and we did leave or remain. You know, we have a list of people, and you've got to say, oh, you know, cheese and onion is leave, and salt and vinegar is remain, all that kind of stuff. And Dorian Lynskey did the Beatles, and he said Lennon would be a Lexiter.
So what's a Lexiter?
That's like Labour Brexit, working class Labour Brexit. So John Lennon, when he had a Mao cap on, would be a Lexiter, but later in life he'd be a Remainer. When he did Double Fantasy and got all kind of wet and touchy.
You realise this isn't the other podcast?
I know. But this is what's going on, man. It's what's going on. We have two guests this week. Hannah Verdier writes about telly and podcasts for The Guardian, and she runs the excellent Podcast Bangers newsletter. We listen to all the podcasts, so you don't have to. Hello, Hannah. How are you doing?
Hi. Good, thanks.
The idea is actually that they do have to listen to the podcasts, so that's what we're trying to encourage.
Oh, yes, of course, that. But I just pick the good ones.
There you go. Obviously, the only podcasts they need to listen to are Big Mouth and Remain X. But what's good? What's breaking through? What's a piping hot podcast?
Oh, apart from that, I can't think. No, I can. I really hate true crime.
You really hate true crime.
I do, but I realise that everyone likes it. But there's a new one called Murderabilia, which takes it even further. Just people talking about their souvenirs of murder. Just horrible. But it's kind of done without judgment, and it's really, really good.
Done without judgment? What, like murder? You might be for it, you might be against it. Like, pro or con?
Is murder Brexit?
You've got to listen to all sides of the
murder
argument.
Murder Brexit, manslaughter Remain.
Brexicide. There you go. There's a little bit of the Venn diagram. I'm going to launch a podcast called Brexicide. I don't know what it's going to be about.
Oh, Brexicize, I thought you were going to say.
Brexicize.
7 minute.
A combination of Brexit and circumcise.
Yeah, some Farage.
Can I pitch that idea? Can I just take it?
No, I'm quickly registering the URL right now. Now, as the Guardian soap person, you were recently bigging up the women, making EastEnders great again. A, again, and B, who and how?
Well, I stopped watching EastEnders. I think a lot of people maybe went off it a little bit when they had massive bus crashes and explosions and ridiculousness and storylines about bin days. But now, I went away for the weekend and I noticed everyone disappeared for an hour. Like, what are they doing? They're watching EastEnders.
Right.
And I think it's the women. It's your Kat Slater, your Bianca. They're strong. They're booby, they're feisty. I love them.
Mm.
But it is really good at the moment.
Are they getting better stories?
Yeah, I think the storylines are a lot juicier at the moment and it's turned a corner, I think, and I've started watching.
Yeah.
I recommend it.
Sorry, Coronation Street used to be the big matriarch.
Yes.
Then. How is that for the matriarchs now? Has EastEnders stolen it?
No, I think Coronation Street still is. I think EastEnders stole, well, borrowed the producer that was on Emmerdale and also Coronation Street, and she brings in these big, juicy stories. I'm not saying that the men aren't good, because a lot of people said, well, what about the male characters?
Is this the same person who says, you know, I've got a new job and the way I come in to remake this is you need to have a plane crash on the set or a tram crash.
Yeah, there's always those guys.
So big siege.
Yeah, so it's like you've been handed, I don't know, Dr. Foster, needs a plane crash. You've been handed Balamori, needs a plane crash. That
Peppa
kind of
Pig,
thing.
Yeah.
Peppa Pig needs a plane crash. Pig plane. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Miss Rabbit would fly the plane, wouldn't she?
She does everything.
She doesn't, I know.
Good heavens. Well, you can hear him now.
You certainly can. Joining us this week, you just heard him. It's Michael Hogan. Also writes about telly, entertainment, and other fun things for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and anyone else who knows me. Hello, Michael. How are you?
Hi.
How are you doing?
All right.
You worked for Sky magazine in the glory years.
Yeah.
Zoe Ball covers, Tara Reid, fun times. How was that? Do you think that Sky could come back in a similar way that The Face just has?
Quite possibly. Yeah, I'd love it to. I mean, there's that, but, you know, magazines are dropping like flies around us, aren't they? So it would be a bold move to bring
it back. But it had a USP, didn't it? What made it different?
Well, it was unisex. That was the thing. Mm. And it was sort of a grown-up smash hits was the loose pitch. And it was a time when there were lots of sexy boys and girls around. And
are they not around anymore?
Well, I think maybe, you know, women's magazines and sort of lad magazines kind of ghettoised the genders in a way.
Mm.
People didn't read the same magazine as their female friends and male friends. So, I don't know, would they do that again now? You know, it's all like Levi's ads and Calvin Klein ads and loads of hot people hanging out together.
Mm. Don't you can do that these days, can you? the naked issue, the sex issue, every time it seemed to be.
But only once a year.
Sky did used to also have like...
I remember it.
It used to have like feelings in it, and it was okay for like lads to read about feelings.
Oh, friends who sleep
which is all back
other.
Now. Feelings are back now. Feelings are back, aren't they? So.
No, too many feelings now.
Yeah,
oh, dear. The feels. I worked for Sky for a couple of articles. One of them was for about art, and I'd show people art, and they'd tell me what they thought of it. And I rang up Tracy Emin when she did her a shop in Brick Lane. And she actually spoke over the phone, and we did the feature over the phone, which was amazing. I just phoned her, you know, just out of the blue. I met her subsequently, and she went, oh, yeah, I normally wouldn't have done that sort of thing. I just felt sorry for you that you had all this writing to do and no one to do it with you. So that was wonderful. So I love Sky for that. The Sky DNA was actually passed on to Heat magazine in a way. When
yeah,
Heat was
yeah.
Good.
Lots of our team went and worked on Heat, especially Mark Frith, who was the editor.
Of course, until Heat.
It was that kind of, it was sort of that sort of celebratory attitude towards pop culture rather than sneery.
Mm.
And the kind of, you know, the Technicolor fun world of entertainment certainly was passed on to Heat, yeah.
Yeah. Give us your quick take on the Emmys. Did Britain really win everything in a pre-Brexit kind of way?
Yeah, it did actually. Well, it won a third. Statistically, it won just slightly over a third of the Emmys given out, which is extraordinary, I think. And, you know, normally in days of yore, we'd get like a couple of prizes. You know, like Hugh Laurie would get one for House, or Maggie Smith would get one for Downton Abbey. And that would be on the front page of the papers. But this year, we got 10 from the Primetime Emmys and another 13 at the kind of the Creative Emmys, which is the more technically sort of nerdy ones. Which is extraordinary, yeah. I mean, Phoebe Waller-Bridge was responsible for quite a lot of them.
Yes, and that's a famous picture of her with her martini.
Yeah,
it's fabulous. Surrounded by exactly. And a fag. Yes,
but again, you know, it was the BBC did very well. There was and you know, strong women did well, Killing Eve and Fleabag, and it was lovely to see things like Succession and you know, Ben Whishaw get them as well. Mm. And obviously Phoebe Waller-Bridge is the kind of the face of our Emmy success, but. Mm-hmm. I think it was a real lovely thing for our TV industry and just sort of testament to how great we are at telly.
I'm waiting for the pic of Ben Whishaw with the martini surrounded by M. He's having a fag as well.
Yeah.
Andrew.
With his Paddington overcoat on, maybe his duffel coat.
Yes, I think it'll be rather wonderful. What's on the show this week, Andrew?
Mods. Were you a mod? When were you a mod? Who was the best at being a mod? Mods. Sky Arts just ran a mod weekend and it's still on the Sky Player. We're going to be looking at Bradley Wiggins on mods and Quadrophenia, our generation, to fathom the endless appeal of shouting, we are the mods, we are the mods, we are indeed the mods. It's going to be an interesting cultural deep dive, or is it a well-end extravaganza? We're going to be finding out. Plus, for the long hairs and the reefer smokers, Kettering Groovers' Temples are back with their third album, Hot Motion. Is it any good? And how are we feeling about cosmic glam with actual space fro hairdos? And State of the Union, Nick Hornby's new short format black comedy featuring Rosamund Pike and Chris O'Dowd as a couple undergoing marriage therapy. Does it speak to an eternal truth about men and women, and how's the lulzometer on this one? Remember, every episode of Big Mouth can be yours a day early if you support us on the Patreon crowdfunding platform. Bunga's the price of a pint once a month, a mere £5, and we'll send you the podcast as soon as it's ready. Pledge us the price of 2 pints, and we'll sort you out with a lovely Big Mouth mug too, so you can alert family and colleagues to your exquisite good taste. Plus, everybody gets the hand-milled extra bit, a mini additional podcast just for Patreon people. This week, in honour of mods, we're going to be confessing to the youth cults that got us when we were young and impressionable, and that should be interesting. Search Patreon Big Mouth to find out more. All we're saying is buy us a pint. Right then, mods. Big weekend for gents of a certain age as Sky Arts staged their mod weekend based around Quadrophenia, trigger to the mod revival of 40 years ago. Among the delights in store is Bradley Wiggins on mods and Phil Daniels presenting a documentary on Quadrophenia. Did we enjoy it? Did we learn anything? And what is the persistent appeal of mod to men who fight the noble battle to keep their weller haircuts intact? Before we talk about it, let's get in the mood with The High Numbers, a.k.a. The Who, with I'm the Face.
I'm the face, baby, is that good? I'm the face, baby, is that good? I'm the face if you want it. I'm the face if you want it, dear. All the others are third class tickets by me, baby, is that clear? I'm the big wheel, baby, won't you roll with me? I'm the big wheel, baby, won't you roll with me?
Bit of your actual mod there, Hannah. What is it with men and mod? What's the eternal appeal?
Why is it just men and mod? I spent a lot of my 20s as a sad mod revivalist.
You're a modette.
I was, actually. I had the hair and everything, and I've come dressed as Ocean Colour Scene today.
What was the hair?
The bob, but it's very Mary Quant. It's graduated, so you have the back very short.
Okay.
Not the Weller hair. I didn't have that.
Yeah, doesn't look good on ladies. It is certainly the case of men of a certain age.
Yeah.
There's like, you don't see 60-year-old punks. You don't see 60-year-old... Poor old rockabillys have all died out, I think. But go to Brighton on a bank holiday weekend and tubby mods can be seen scootering around.
Well, I think you'll find, as Weller said in the documentary, it's a faith, isn't it? It's a faith.
Yeah.
And I love it when people have the same music taste and they keep it throughout their life. I think it's brilliant. It's a devotion to it. And I can see why. This is good music. This is good style.
I would never do that, he said in his ZTT t-shirt.
Yeah, hang on.
what do we think of Bradley Wiggins on mods, the documentary? Brad goes on a quest, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. I mean, he's always, whenever he's been on documentaries before, he's always had a little bit of mod in the background and it's how he relaxes. But he's so deadpan, it feels like he's joking the whole time. And he's swagging around Kilburn and saying that Britpop and Oasis was a gateway drug to this. And when I love the bit where he's interviewing Weller, and Paul Weller's been so prickly as ever, and Bradley Wiggins is just emotionless, just trying to get through the questions. And it's just, yeah, but I like him. I can't help but like him. And my favourite bit, you say it's all about the men, but it was when the ladies were, Pat and Sandy.
There is a great moment where they rediscover the original, the scene. The
yes.
Club The Scene, which is underneath, not far from the Soho Radio Studio.
Right.
They're digging around in this Stygian underground. They find the club. Yeah. And they go there with two of the girls who were discovered there.
Yes.
And went on to, it's like it changed their lives, didn't it?
Yeah, was one of them a dancer on Ready, Steady, Go?
One of them went on to become a dancer.
She was so fabulous. And they were sitting there, like, they're having a good old giggle about Purple Hearts and the good old days. And they get up and have a dance. And Wiggins is just sitting there as if say, what is going on here?
So yeah, they found a couple of old mod skeletons in the corner. Two-tailed scarves moulding around their necks.
No, I loved that bit, actually.
That was a very touching bit. Michael, what did you reckon? I mean, because it's... Well, one of the things with mod is it takes itself so seriously.
Yeah, it wasn't big on laws. Bradley has, you know, you might say he was deadpan, but or you might say he's got no discernible sense of humour. I don't think the documentary makers at the BAFTAs have anything to worry about with Bradley. I think it was one of the things that amused me about it was that he said, made a point of saying at the beginning of the film, it's filmed over 6 months. And then he got a massive haircut in the middle of it. So, like, you kept flicking between him interviewing various people with, like, entirely different hair.
Yeah.
Bad continuity Bradley. No, it wasn't that good. It was basically three or four interviews strung together with some archive footage.
But to be fair, some of the archive stuff was quite good.
The archive was good, but it was sort of good despite Bradley rather than because of him, I feel.
Mm. Sean, what did you reckon?
It was a lot better than I thought it was going to be, is the first thing. You got Wiggo, he's all right, he's the people's saviour. He is training to be a social worker, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's actually more interesting.
Well,
more,
empathy,
think,
he was showing.
Hence he has a nervous breakdown and the hair goes...
The bit on the council estate and stuff, when he was saying where he grew up, that was
I thought that was really interesting. They also got Peter Blake, who invented half of the iconography of mod that the Who stole, which is in the documentary itself. I think those things are interesting. It's when they start talking about the music and the clubs that we've just heard this all before. Yes, we know that you went to the scene. Yes, we know that you danced like that. It was sort of what was around mod rather than what was within it.
Yeah, it wasn't helped by the sort of, I don't think, the weekend-long mod fest. And this was on the Sunday evening. So by the time that was on telly, you'd kind of been modded out a bit.
Were you having a bit of a come down by
then? it was all the same material, essentially, kind of strung out repeatedly over the weekend.
Well,
Bradley Wiggins on mods does sound like something that Alan Partridge would do.
It does, yeah. The Quadrophenia, Our Generation documentary presented by Phil Daniels. I've got a terrible confession. I've never actually seen Quadrophenia. I've only ever seen it in bits. I've only ever seen this clip and that clip.
I think you're fine with that.
It's one of those films you only see bits of, isn't it? And you only know the catchphrases.
But I do clearly remember when it came out, literally 60% of the boys at school immediately went out and got 1968 haircuts and parkas and white socks and were like, I'm a mod now. I'm entirely a mod. And that, although, you know, the bit that stood out on the various clips, and I remember it from, from previous talk, is that kind of massively ironic line where it goes, what is it? You know, I don't want to be like anybody else. That's why I'm a mod. And they're all bloody identical marching around.
It's like Life of Brian.
It is a bit like Life of Brian. Sean, what did you make of the Quadrophenia documentary with Phil, Park Life Daniels?
Park Life. Had to do that. I don't know. I didn't actually get through all of it. Toya Wilcox, who now refers to herself in the third person.
That was extraordinary.
That's amazing.
Interesting. And yet they're all talking about a film that I hadn't bothered to watch the film either over the weekend, because I've seen it. And, you know, you have seen it once. You've seen it once, really. I don't know. I think that was too much navel gazing. Isn't he wonderful, the director? Isn't he? Yeah, yeah, fine. I think they could have made that 30 minutes and I would have been very happy. Mr. Sting is in it with his strange transatlantic accent. They all seem incredibly disparate, and yet people keep saying, no, the great friends still. The great friends now. No, they're not. Toya Wilcox and Phil Daniels in the pub, don't think so.
Toya, what's that about? She's gone totally lovely. She's really affected. Yes. She kept talking about Toya. The brand.
Yes.
Yeah. Really? It's like, what the hell? Yeah. There is no brand.
That's what Mod did to her.
Yeah. But I mean, I suppose.
She's never a Mod.
People like Phil Daniels, who I used to play football with, actually. He's a lovely chap. Oh. The guy who used to play DC, Jim Carver and The Bill, and Ray Winston. I think there was a certain kind of warmth and camaraderie between those, but it was sort of a bog standard. Clips and Talking Head show, wasn't it?
I did. I mean, having not investigated this particularly deeply, I did not know that John Lydon was up to play Jimmy, or that Keith Moon had basically died the week.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, they were good takeaways, I think.
Yeah, and you kind of you forget that, like, this album came out, what is it, recorded 77, comes out in 1978, films out in 1979. This is only really 10 years since Mod itself took place, and yet felt like an eternity. Whereas on current timescale, it's like, well, we're in 29. What was happening in 2009? You know, Girls Aloud had just split up or something. It doesn't seem like a very long time. And yet you saw those pictures of Daltrey in his kind of, you know, curly-haired, you know, bare-chested finery, sitting in Alfredo's Cafe with everybody in full Mod gear. And it looks like he looks like a time traveller.
No trout farm there.
No trout farm, yeah. Hannah, did you get much from it?
I got about 45 minutes through, but I wasn't that interested. I was quite interested in the way that Johnny Lydon wouldn't touch it because it had the Who's music in
well,
it.
Well, he's built the myth there. Apparently the truth is...
Oh, come on.
The truth is that the film's distributors wouldn't insure him because he was too dangerous. So obviously John's repackaged that as,
I
wouldn't
that.
Be in a film with the Who's music in it because I'm a punk.
Yeah. I mean, again, something else that this too reiterated the kind of, you know, on one hand, I don't want to sort of like mock anybody's real pop moment, the thing that defined them, because you should always respect people's passions. And yeah, the music is incredible. And, you know, the clothes are pretty good and the haircuts are pretty good. But it is the real sort of blokey humorlessness of it. You're right.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
girls
true.
Are a bit, you know, girls are a big deal in Mod, but the men of Mod.
That's what everyone thinks of. But I liked it in the Bradley Wiggins thing where he obviously comes from a family like that when he says to his nan, do you remember when I first got into music? She's like, no. Yeah. That was it. That was a clip that they showed.
But it did make me kind of understand a little bit better the idea that, you know, the people who were getting into this scene, they weren't like me. They were coming from a, you know, a much more deprived, much more kind of, you know, it was only the very beginnings of the consumer society, and the idea that you're the first in your family to have disposable money in your pocket to go out and spend it on stuff. And you come from a working class background and you want to spend it on looking sharp.
Yes, he gets some really good clothes. I do love that idea, though.
I think that's the kind of the likeable thing about Mod culture is that quite rarely for a youth subculture it's about working class kids dressing up rather than middle class kids dressing down and slumming it. Which, you know, and so it has got that kind of underdog kind of likability to it. But I think over the years, I mean, you know, it was a film made in 79 about the 60s, and now we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of it. It's like nostalgia about nostalgia.
Yeah.
And it does start to look a little bit like some sad old men with silly haircuts.
I think if you took Quadrophenia out of it and explored the whole scene a little bit more, it would have been a lot better, actually. Because I think Quadrophenia is a bit of a... It's just a little bit awful, and it takes away from the great music that they had in the 60s and the Small Faces and Kinks.
Yeah.
I think I'd want to know more about that rather than
and
the
also
film
the
itself.
Things they skirted, which things like the drug culture of the time, saying we didn't drink, we took Dexys and we did Purple Hearts. I think that's more interesting about working class culture having access to that and a different world post war. That's what I would like, a swotty kind of version of it, maybe.
The aspect of it, I've ever since like kids at school started like digging out a Parker, the aspect I always found most difficult about it was like the hierarchy of who's Mod enough. I'm more Mod than you. So I never wanted to be a Mod or have anything to do with it. But
you're just bitter because they wouldn't let you in.
Maybe that's what it is. But it's just like, you know, you're kind of your escape from kind of, you know, the closed-in world is to set up your own little prison, your own little rule book.
At my school, it was very much, you know, there were like, I remember in sort of 79, 80, when Potterina came out, there was like mods v rockers in the playground.
Great.
Nobody really knew what it meant. It was just like cops and robbers or cowboys and Indians, you know what I mean, or Man U against Liverpool. That's all it meant.
What does Roy Winston say? Anyway, I don't give a monkey's arse all about mods and rockers. Underneath, we're all the same, innit? Yeah. So that's, I think, words to live by.
I don't want to be the same.
I want to be different, like everybody else.
Park life.
All were confused.
Anyway, let's have a sharp contrast in musical form and style, and yet stay at the British seaside for some reason. We always ask our guests to choose a tune for the show in their editor's recommendation. Hannah Verdier, I believe you've got a tune which comes complete with a view of the channel.
Yes, it does. I have got the beautiful Pet Shop Boys featuring Ollie from Years and Years with Dreamland, and it's one of those songs I just think it's a real return to form for them. Not they're ever off form. And to make something that relevant right now, I love it.
So it's both like the idea of escaping to another world, but also Dreamland in Margate.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, by the sea.
But what more do you want? Yeah. I love everything about it, and it makes me so happy. And I love the older man, younger man duet. It's brilliant. And I saw them do it live at Hyde Park and it was patchy, but the whole thing was amazing.
Yeah, don't rub it in.
Yeah,
all right. All right, here we go. Let's have a listen. This is the Pet Shop Boys with Dreamland.
I'm so tired of my homeland. When I fall asleep, you lead the way.
Now, if intergalactic mind rock trio Temples were any more 1967, they'd be setting fire to Jimi Hendrix's guitar at the Finsbury Park Astoria while describing Britain as the sick man of Europe and using the first ever cash machine in Anfield and ending the production of the Ford Anglia. All things happened in 1967. Verisimilitude is their middle name. It's third album time for Temples after moving on from Heavenly Records to ATO. What is Hot Motion all about and do we like it? Pull up a beanbag. This is the title track. Temples with Hot Motion from the album of the same name, the eponymous album of the same name. It's also self-titled. No, it isn't. Surely.
Keep that in.
That was brilliant.
A long week.
I didn't even notice.
That was genuinely like someone having a stroke live on air.
Right,
like when Tommy Cooper died that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
Tommy Cooper dying every week live on the air. Right. Okay. Start that one again. Temples with Hot Motion from the album of the same name out on Friday. Michael Hogan, how are you on the old space rock cosmic glam? How's your stuck heels?
My heels are filed down and flat. I didn't really like this, to be honest with you. It was kind of one of those albums where, I don't know, it just felt like a little bit too enthralled to its influences. I kind of couldn't. I ended up sort of spotting things that sounded like other things rather than enjoying the album itself. Having said that, I wasn't really terribly familiar with Temple's oeuvre, although, you know, I looked them up online and it said that Noel Gallagher likes them. So, you know, make of that what you will. It was kind of neo-psychedelia in that kind of way. It's a bit MGMT, a bit Tame Impala, like Wild Beasts without the kind of brilliant voice guy. Quite meat and potatoes-y, I thought.
So they certainly do look the part. One of them looks like Roger Waters, one of them looks like Noel Redding, and one of them looks like Noel Fielding. So they've kind of got
the various Noels.
Yes, a lot of how many Noels it takes to fill the Albert Hall.
Well, Noel Edmonds.
There you go. They do actually look. They've taken the time and the effort to look like rock stars. It is very heavy on the Mellotrons and the Galaxy Class riffs. Do you think they spent too much time listening to Pink Floyd and Love?
I think so. It's sort of there's 11 tracks on the album and you know, by number 9, you're like, okay, here comes some more glam rock drums and slightly fuzzy guitar and frazzled sounding layered vocals. It was just a little bit one note and a bit pastiche for me.
Hannah, you're from Kettering. Does this speak to you?
Oh, I was determined to like it because they're from Kettering. Unless you're from there, you don't know the horror. And I can see that hair is their pure escapism.
Yeah.
It's a strange place. And we haven't got any celebrities, really, apart from Karthik from The Apprentice.
What about, isn't brilliant stand-up comedian James Acaster from Kettering?
He's our latest one, yeah. But right. before that, we had to borrow Bauhaus from Northampton. That was the nearest town. So Kettering and temples, I wanted to like it. I don't think it was made for me, I have to say that. I think it's made for people who didn't go through a kind of 90s revival of big hair psych music. I think it's for the young'uns. I think there were some good songs on there. I thought they had some cracking harmonies in Hot Motion, the title track. Mm-hmm. I think You're Either On Something was good. It had the big drums. But by about track 4 or 5, I was losing it a little bit. Also, The Howl brought a bit of a Doctor in the TARDIS flashback for me.
Nothing wrong with that. Well, that is a particularly astonishing track because it's got this kind of marching band rumpety-tump thing.
Yes.
That then goes straight into... And not every listener owns a copy of Junk Shop Glam, the Phil King's compilation of terrible old glam rock records. But there's a track on that called Kick Your Boots Off or something. It sounds exactly like this. That feels like it's fallen straight from a time hole in 1973 right to now, doesn't it?
Yeah, I reckon they might have been tinkering with their dad's record collection a little bit. Or is it their granddad's? It's hard to tell.
Ooh, harsh.
And no, but they've said that on this album they're stripping everything back, but I don't think they are. I think they're chucking quite a lot at it. I wouldn't want to see them at full pelt if this is them stripping it back.
That's what the fact that they kind of throw everything at it is one of the many things I like about it. Because this is one of these weird bands where I don't really like any of the things that they like, but I like them. You know,
right.
I've run a mile from Pink Floyd. But the difference for me is that this is that feel, that cosmicness, that expansion, but with songs. The songs are songs. The songs are 3 minutes and 20 seconds. You know, tight in, verse, chorus, proper melodies. And that track you mentioned, You're Either On Something or You're Up to Something, it's like Super Fairy Animals. You know, it's intensely whistleable.
Yeah, I think there was one later on, I think it was Context, was a really melodic one. And I thought that had a bit of the Super Fairies about it.
I do like a band that can call a track Context, though. That's like...
Yes.
It's thinky.
Thinky and hard to rhyme with.
How mod are they?
Very, very non-mod. Actually, you know what?
If you
put them into timeline,
Paisley,
they would have been mods when they started out. They would have been, if they'd existed in the 90s, they would have started out with severe haircuts and sharp suits.
Like status quo.
And they would have gone through it all. And they probably would have done some sessions with Joe Meek up in the Holloway Road. And then they would have done a Granny Takes a Trip. They would have brought Guardsman's jackets and little lenses. And then the hair would have exploded. Mm. And then they'd become what they are now.
I think I prefer this parallel timeline to the actual Kettering-based reality.
I have a theory about this, which is we could pick them up in a time scoop, dump them back to 1967, and it would stop prog rock from being awful because they are songs.
Should we do it?
Could do. They are about songs. They are about a 3.5-minute disciplined, whistleable thing, not 12 minutes of multiple movements.
There are a couple of 6-minute tracks on there. Come on.
Yeah, but they only feel like 3. That's the whole point, you see.
Oh, I thought they felt not like 9.
Sean, what did you think?
Well, I think the great irony of the 1967 We Got No Synths on Our Record Band is they sound like a Vodafone advert. I can imagine the first one, what we played, Hot Motion, being in the background to, hey, it's a festival and you could bring your phone and maybe you get 5G. There's something quite super shiny about it. There's also a lot of lyrics about horses and things in the sky. And I do worry about that. Holy horses lighting the sky, holy horses lighting the wind, do you think?
That's how we roll in Kettering.
Yeah, is that, you know, sometimes... What I want is a bit of psychedelia, but for you to sing your phone bill or something else, you know, just something to make it sort of a bit
They'd support Kasabian at a kind of corporate festival.
Miles better than Kasabian.
They reminded me of Kasabian. It also reminded me of Love Power, the great song in The Producers, when Lorenzo Saint-Dubois sings his hippie anthem. And it's a bit, we're veering towards hippie anthem here, and I'm not sure that I can just do hippie...
But are they? They are fundamentally, basically, a Jimi Hendrix power trio, aren't they? They're like three of them: guitar, bass, drums.
There's no extra bit. There's no extra edge. I think you get into Lars territory where it's just so reverential.
You take that back.
I want the extra bit. I want them to sing about the broadband.
I'm not having you knocking the Lars on this podcast. You take.
Are you still reeling from being rejected by the mods at school?
Well, I think these guys would have been mods, but they would have then have rejected mod. as their hair exploded. Did you get possibly a bit of Dukes of Stratosphere vibe from them?
No, say it's still, it was reeking of Kasabian. Yeah. Reeking of it. I was imagining Glastonbury BBC.
A tiny little dab of Muse behind the ears.
Oh, yes,
as well.
A little.
This is the Muse.
Yeah. Oh, we've all been guilty of that sometimes.
No, we haven't.
Because I think
it's just me.
If you're talking about Muse, I quite like the way they go full pomp. And I'm feeling that temples are trying to steer away from pomp, but actually a bit of that, a bit of humour, maybe. I respect
that. A bit of pomp and personality would have been welcome, I think.
I don't know. I like the ridiculousness of them, and I like their image as well. I saw them being interviewed somewhere, and they were once again quite deadpan behind.
Was it on Kettering Today?
Don't knock it.
Yeah.
Lost in the K-hole. Kettering
hole.
Kettering
hole. Yeah.
No, and also being a trio, the same thing as with Muse and lots of other bands that try really hard.
Mm-hmm.
I like a trio. They have to kind of put it out there. They've not got enough people.
Sugar Babes.
Yes, true.
Yep.
Yeah.
All of them.
Exactly the same.
Who's
basically
on bass in Sugar Babes? Yeah.
Well, I would respond as Queen Victoria would, we are not a Muse. That's what she would say to this. I quite liked it. I think it's, but then, you know, it's kind of just that, it's the cosmicness that I like. The cosmicness that, the cosmicness.
Cosmic Harrison, that's you.
Go.
Yeah. Right, let's have some more music. Why not? Another tune recommended by our panel. Michael Hogan of The Guardian fame. What have you brought in for us?
And The Telegraph. I brought in Sugar Honey Iced Tea.
Yes.
Which is the new single by Princess Nokia. And do you see what she did with those initials?
Mm-hmm.
Sugar Honey Iced Tea.
Oh,
so it's a new single from the New York Puerto Rican rapper. It's really good. It's kind of like a bit stripped back. It's got lots of finger snaps, the odd blast of horn. The video is really good. It's inspired by the New York ball culture that you see in TV's Pose. And these bitches want to fight me. They doing shit just to spite me. I see them talking on the IG, which I believe is Instagram.
I believe it is. Let's hear it. Sugar Honey Iced Tea by Princess Nokia.
Sugar Honey Iced Tea. These bitches don't like me. These bitches won't fight me. And doing shit just to spite me. I see them talking on the IG. Think you jealous, maybe high key. I got the juice, I got the high C. Do I care? Unlikely. You want some time on your hands, cause all that time you been hating. I know you mad that I'm famous, I know you mad that I made it. With all the time.
Right, State of the Union is Nick Hornby's take on the breakup genre and is remarkably simple. Two people sit in a pub for 10 minutes and talk before they go see their marriage counsellor. Starring Rosamund Pike and Chris O'Dowd, it's directed by Stephen Frears. Hey, big names on the BBC. But is it more seen through the bottom of a pint glass than scenes from a marriage? Let us listen to the trailer.
Can I ask you something?
And it's happening to us now. Should we talk about why we stopped making love?
Why did you sleep with someone else?
What's the point of being married if there's no sex?
How many times did you sleep with this guy?
Making it through.
Isn't that the goal of every marriage? Making it through?
Fight for your marriage! Fight!
Are we a couple? Two against the world, or aren't we?
Interesting fact, the State of the Union trailer there. When I looked online, there were about 10 different trailers. There's a very prim one from the BBC. There's a medium Facebook one. They're all slightly different. This one, which Andrew chose, is all about sex.
I chose it because it was a short one.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Mentioned sex a lot, Andrew.
Well, Andrew, sex and mods, Harrison.
Yeah.
That's me.
Yeah, that is, and temples. Michael, would you set this up for us? We have Rosamund Pike,
we do.
Chris O'Dowd, and we believe they're married but going through some difficulties.
Yeah, she's a doctor called Louise.
Mm-hmm.
He's a unemployed music journalist.
Mm.
Imagine that happening.
Totally unrealistic. Where do they get their ideas from?
It's one of those obscure
ludicrous
fantasy dramas. Absolutely. Like Game of Thrones.
I know.
We gradually learn over the course of the 10 episodes. It's subtitled A Marriage in 10 Parts. And we see them each week in the pub waiting for their marriage counselling session across the road. They always have the same drink. He has a pint of London Pride, sometimes a packet of dry roasted nuts. She has a glass of white wine. And we kind of gradually learn as it kind of unfolds what's been going on in their marriage. She's had a kind of short-lived, fairly desultory affair. He's lost interest in sex. They've kind of become friends more than lovers. And they summarise their marriage as being about the kids and crosswords and Game of Thrones when it's on. Yeah, it's kind of funny and touching and serious. It's kind of quite stagey to start with, I think. It feels like a, because it's essentially a two-hander, it feels like a play to start with. But don't give up after episode one if you don't love it, because I think by episode three,
right,
it gets very addictive. It's very bingeable, little 10 to 15-minute episodes. Yeah, it's a snacky delight, I think.
Now, the key to this is that they have to make the characters believable for you to go on their journeyman. Are Rosamund Pike and Chris O'Dowd up to the job?
I think he is. I'm not sure she is.
Okay.
I found her a little bit cold, and she sounds like she's delivering Nick Hornby's lines at times, whereas he kind of inhabits his character much better.
I have a theory about that, but carry on.
I'd like to hear your theory.
Hannah, no, I want to ask Hannah, what do you think about the believability of Rosamund Pike, Hollywood actress, and Chris O'Dowd, Hollywood actor?
Well, I did get past the second, the first two weren't brilliant, got past the second one and then binged the lot and loved it, but I've got so many problems with it as well.
Okay, so what did you love about it first?
It's just really easy to watch, and I really wanted to know what happened in the end, so they convinced me in that way. I think they are a pretty convincing couple. I can imagine that when they started, whatever, 15, 20 years ago, they were quite different. You can imagine him being the cool music writer who still had a job and her being an up-and-coming doctor.
Yeah.
And so I can see how they might have grown and grown apart, looking into it quite a lot there. But I found the dialogue a little bit too clever and too staged, and the kind of comforting, tinkling jazz, everything's going to be okay theme. And they didn't, for me, I didn't think they had any real problems, but I can see how they were in that situation. And I kind of wanted, I don't want to spoiler it here, but I wasn't totally convinced about how they progressed and what happened in the end.
Okay.
And I was kind of screaming at her, come on, ditch the loser and go on a Tinder spree, mate, come on. I want to see her out the other side. But I don't know, that's just how I feel.
More anti-men's rights propaganda there.
And indeed him.
From Big Prop Podcast.
But also he's got that thing that's like, he talked in an interview about them being a bit mismatched and, oh, she was punching above her weight, and that those are kind of horrible phrases, and I can see that, but he's got that kind of lovable bumbling man of a certain age thing going on, that she, you can see she's just rolling her eyes at him the whole time, and I don't know, it was that kind of pure Nick Hornby thing,
yeah,
and I kind of loved it but hated it in equal measure.
You can tell it's written by a man. I think he gets most of the best lines.
Andrew, do you agree?
I found it hard to believe that they had got together in the first place. They are such different people. I found the kind of Chris O'Dowd overgrown man-child thing slightly done to death, actually. What interested me in it was, told over and over again how fantastic the dialogue is. It's really, really, no line is wasted. Everything's snappy. Everything's super, super potent. And I'm not sure it entirely delivers on that. What did surprise me was the kind of, there's a sort of artificiality and stiltedness to the dialogue. Who in a long-term married relationship is so earnest that they would say slept with rather than shagged? Who would say making love instead of saying shagging? That's what, married couples do not have this kind of pre-edited BBC Two kind of propriety. And
it's a very transatlantic drama. I mean, maybe that's one reason why they didn't use phrases like shagging, because they had an eye on the international market.
But when you compare it to things like Catastrophe and Fleabag, where people really behave the way people behave, there is an absolutely plausible grain of reality to it. And the way that the characters in Catastrophe in particular, who can go from great tenderness to bickering, right back to great tenderness, to a row, to completely spinning off to another subject entirely, that's the way people behave. And I sort of found the kind of the way these characters seemed to be following the idea of what a character like that ought to be, rather than what a person in that situation would do, because we're sort of trapped in a loop here. They're always in the pub having variants on the same conversation, aren't they? They're either meeting before their marriage counselling, or they're waiting for the other one, or they're having a bit of a standoff, which does make it quite theatery and quite stagey. But at no point do they do what real people do, which is veer off the script. Look out the window and go, look at that pigeon.
There's no silences. They speak eloquently. They don't stop talking. Whereas if you're in marriage counselling, often you'd stop talking because it's really uncomfortable when you're meeting before in the pub. But my big theory was that I think that Rosamund Pike's lines are actually all, when you take them out of context, they're very cold. And Chris O'Dowd is the warm, fuddly, flawed one. But she's brilliant at bringing warmth to them. She's really trying to do that. I think it's the Nick Hornby writing. I think it's odd. Everything she says is quite steely and not particularly nice. And she's actually doing a brilliant job in trying to make a real person out of that. And I had a problem with that, is I just didn't
really my missus winced at some of her lines.
They're nasty.
Because she keeps saying these things like, everyone in a marriage fantasizes about leaving, and everyone in a marriage fantasizes about this. And they go, do they?
You know, she's a lot of generalizing.
Yeah, she does seem quite hard. And you're right, there is a kind of theatrical middle class smugness to it.
There's an enormous
It's very Waitrosey, and it's in a North London gastro pub.
And it's not, it's in Hammersmith. You keep seeing the sign that says W6.
Huh. When that line popped up, she says, everybody in a marriage fantasizes about their partner leaving. I thought Chris O'Dowd's character was immediately going to say, do they? Have you asked them all?
Yeah, or dying, because, not leaving.
Yeah,
because then you get the sympathy.
Yeah, but I thought that, you know,
his
character would have reacted in that way. You know, his character is so querulous and pokey and nosy. I thought it was full of little kind of cracks where you thought, there's a thing that should happen there, and it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. David Mamet, I think, wrote, because of the king of dialogue, said all dialogue is people talking to themselves. They're never talking to one another. Conversations are people talking about
themselves.
It's
what they don't say. And we've got what people say. We've not got anywhere near what they're not saying to each other.
There's all these kind of overextended metaphors as well, aren't there? Like quite Alan Partridge-y. Yeah. They kind of go, oh, if our relationship was Usain Bolt, it would be Mo Farah.
No one's going to think of that.
It's kind of like, you know, things that might sound good on the page but don't sound good coming out of people's mouths.
So I've got a question. What would this be like if it was directed by Shane Meadows? Fucking brilliant. He'd chop half the dialogue. There would be silences. There'd be realism, bit handheld. I think part of it is the Stephen Frears. He's a good director, but this is too much his thing. You need someone completely outside.
You need also, Stephen Graham crying.
You've got an English character and you've got an Irish character. English people deal with uncomfortableness and pain and misery with humour. Irish people invented humour, and there is very little actual humour in this. There's kind of snappy little bon mots, but they don't share jokes.
Mm. There's no in jokes, and that's why I thought you have in jokes.
At no point do they go, do you remember when that thing happened?
Yeah. And then they don't talk about the kids. Whereas you'd actually go, when you feel uncomfortable, you'd talk about something else. They've got two kids.
That'd be the main thing you talk about, and then have 2 minutes of something else. But Sean, I really agree with what you say about the whole Nick Hornby writing women. He kind of creates a goddess woman who doesn't really have any warmth or anything. It's just kind of to be looked at.
Yeah, he's a very Nick Hornby archetype, isn't he?
He's
a music nerd. Yeah. He can't grow up. He's stuck in his teens.
Yeah, put an end to this anti-music journalist propaganda. when a Me Too, hashtag Me Too, when a male music journalist is going to get a fair crack of the whip in the media, that's what I know. This struck me as the kind of thing that Sunday Telegraph readers would think is really, really great. Really kind of like, you know, it's searingly real. No, it isn't. It's not
the
searingly
Guardian
real.
Is it? Yeah. Is it uncomfortable to watch, though, if you're in a marriage? Do people sit there and go...
If you're having marriage counselling, you probably wouldn't watch it. Mm. If you're having it at the time, it might be a bit uncomfortable, but for the rest of us...
Fire up the ruffle copter.
Yeah, let's get Tinder.
It's in 10-minute chunks, so you can watch it on the tube or watch it on the bus or watch it whatever.
And then, Dirty Secret.
And people will look over your shoulder and go, oh, yeah, that guy's his missus has kicked him out, hasn't he? Because he's watching this thing about marriage counselling. Look at him.
That's sleeping in the Jag.
Sad guy.
The one thing I thought...
Just turn the winds against me.
The one thing I thought is every episode but one, I think he gets her a dry white wine before she's arrived. God, don't divorce him.
What?
He's getting the drinks in.
Yeah.
Waiting
that's
for
something.
Her when she arrives.
That is something.
This is not real life.
One thing we should talk about is there's the shadow couple. There's the duplicates who are also having...
There's another lot of duplicates as well number eight. Oh. Yeah.
So you see, in the early episodes, you see this couple who are also going to marriage counselling and they do things like punch each other or suddenly start snogging wildly in the street. or one of them sits in the pub crying, and you can't. I looked at it and I thought, I want to see your story.
Yeah, Rosamund
Pike and Chris,
like a sort of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. Like you want to kind of move the camera around and sort of and look at their relationship, which looks a lot more fun.
War of the Roses. Now, there's the thing about marital difficulty with Kathleen Turner, that which has got. It's not realistic, but it's got energy and oomph.
You watch Scenes from a Marriage by Bergman. You don't watch this. That's what we should be watching. Bit culture, mate.
This is Scenes from a Pub. Scenes from a Marriage in a Pub. Anyway. Well, I mean, it went down terribly well, didn't it? People really liked it. Yeah.
Well, it won two Emmys, but it was in some strange category, like about mini-sodes. So like, I think it was like it was the only programme eligible. So Chris O'Dowd and Rosamund Pike both won Best
Acting.
Batten
in the Night Garden.
Oopsie Daisy and Iggle Piggle were kind of right up there.
So we've hit a clean sweep on this one, because basically we didn't really like anything this week, did we? I like Temples.
But I still watched it.
Yeah, I like Temples, but we didn't really like...
I quite liked State of the Union, though, as Deep Before. I'd give that 3 stars out of 5. Temples, 2 stars out of 5.
The best thing on this show is that Pet Shop Boys record, isn't it?
You know it.
Definitely. And Princess Nokia, neck and neck. We've come to the end of the show. And as hordes of marauding rockers descend and chase us out of the studio and out into the lanes of Brighton to kick our heads in, it is time for closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a couple of Dexies and a brown bomber out on the beach as we nurse our head wounds? Hannah Verdier, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, going from the, as we've all agreed, unrealistic State of the Union, I want to go on to Better Things, which is Pamela Adlon, who's nailing the whole single mother trying to work with three kids thing and being really, really hilarious. She plays if you haven't seen it, she's Sam Fox, she's called Sam Fox, an actress who's trying to make it and get bit parts and then get some good parts and just her life. And it's so brilliant. There's one episode where she tries to go away for the weekend without her children and ends up coming back to get them because, yeah, she just feels so bad. And she's always trying to get time for herself and she just does it so beautifully. And she's got the kind of Louis C.K. connection. But I think as she comes out from that and the third season is where she branches out on her own and gets a new writer, she gets even better.
Where is this taking
place? It's like Louis C.K. without the hashtag problematic, isn't it?
Yes.
Where is this taking place and what's it on?
It's on BBC. It's an FX one, but it's actually on BBC now, so you can look at it on iPlayer.
Yeah, it's on BBC too.
Yeah.
That's what I need, another gigantic TV series. So go with all the...
an hour an episode.
I haven't finished Succession yet. Terrible. Michael Hogan, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, it's another massive TV series.
That's what I need.
The Circle, which is Channel 4's exciting, shiny, new social media-based reality show. It debuted last year, and I really, really liked it. I think it's the most exciting reality format. You know, reality TV is quite shy of innovation. You know, a lot of things have been around a long time. But this was a genuine attempt to do something fresh and new. And it started off a bit slowly, but then it got real word of mouth. It's all for the Channel 4 Catch-Up Service's most requested show of last year.
What is it? I mean, I have no idea.
Well, you get 8 people and they move into an apartment block, 1 apartment each. They never meet face-to-face. They can only communicate via this kind of custom-built social network. So they talk to each other across that. Then they try and become influencers, who are the most popular ones, and then they can and those influencers can block other people and eject them from the game.
And it's they can pretend to be someone completely
different, which I think is the pull, isn't it?
It
is. It's kind of if you could be anyone, who would you be? Is the thing. So, the first series was won by a guy pretending to be a girl, and this series they've really run away with that idea. So, Woody, the 18-year-old son of Zoe Ball and Fatboy Slim, that makes you feel old, doesn't it? He's in it, but he's not admitting he's got famous parents because he doesn't want to be prejudged. There's a lesbian model who's playing it straight. There's a scouse bloke posing as a single mother.
And, don't out me, Michael.
And brilliantly, there's a married mum of 4 posing as her 25-year-old son in the hope of finding him a girlfriend, because that's totally normal.
It's a bit weird, but it is kind of sweet.
Yeah,
I mean, in the 17th century, mums would be doing that all the time. Let's marry my son up.
And she also wants to win there's a £100,000 cash prize, doubled last series, an indication of Zoe's success. Mm. And she wants to spend it on a hair transplant for him. So she wants to get him hair and a girlfriend.
Well, that's two dependable Wonderful.
Did this come in as an episode of Black Mirror and they said no?
Well, it is. I mean, it has been described as Big Brother meets Black Mirror, but it's surprisingly engaging, you know, for people sat around in an apartment shouting at screens. You'll find yourself getting really into it. There's something really sweet and kind of endearing about it in little friendships form, and it's surprisingly lovely.
Blimey.
Give it a go.
Good heavens. Sean, what's your closing time, Chester?
Well, I was going to talk about Iggy Pop's shit leather jacket that Gucci gave him. It's got his name on it, and just Iggy Pop just being this strange reappropriation of what punk rock used to be a billion years ago. But I've changed it to Nick Cave talking about Morrissey the person and Morrissey his body of work on Nick Cave's Red Hand Files, because I still think that it brings up a lot of issues about what we have to deal with now. Is this person their art? But what Nick Cave didn't say, and he was beautiful and eloquent and very fair about Smith's songs that he loved and Morrissey now and how we should separate them. But there is a third element in there, because I've been thinking about it. It's one of those things you just keep thinking about. It rumbles on. In that, if that person has those right-wing views, Morrissey, we're talking about, but also those views will filter into his real life. He might be a real-life bastard. Then what do we do then? It's almost as if Nick Cave saying, well, that person doesn't ever do any damage and his songs are really good. Let's separate the person. But I don't think you can. I don't think it's that simple, because we have such a culture of fame. We adore people. We let them get away with bad behaviour in real life. And I'm saying there's still a problematic. It's still hashtag problematic. We haven't quite thought this through. There's too much adulation of bastards is my short.
I used to think Nick Cave was kind of a bit silly with his daft haircut and his bat songs, and I've come to really like and respect him.
Yes.
And obviously I used to love Morrissey, and now I just completely at the end of Morrissey.
But I think there's so much to discuss still about it, and about a person's behaviour and why we idolise these people and put people on pedestals as a society. We're doing it more and more. It's not like we've stopped doing it. Mm. These are our gods. Yeah. We need to question it.
But Nick Cave is kind of...
He used to throw things at people and take heroin, Nick Cave.
But now he's almost like the kind of... He's like the moral conscience of pop culture.
Nick Cave
is a stand-up guy that you trust on things. Mm. And I'm very much looking forward to this surprise album he's putting out next week.
Go Sheen.
Do it on the show next week.
We certainly should, mate.
Brilliant. Yeah. Well, my closing sound chatter is Lady Hale's spider brooch from the Supreme Court judgment that knocked over the government's policy on prorogation. And you've got... You know, the government considers itself to be this unstoppable force that can do whatever it likes and runs up against this... You know, forensic, completely calm and merciless, you know, judgment delivered by somebody who's not your kind of stereotypical, you know, the kind of person you'd expect on a Hollywood drama about what happens in the
Bailey.
Yeah, on look what, sorry?
Rumpole of the
Bailey. She's not a Rumpole figure, but neither is she a kind of, she's not the grand declamatory thing. You know, she's a woman in her 80s or whatever. And she's wearing this little tiny spider brooch, which is such an odd little kind of, you know, it wasn't distracting. It added something peculiar to it. And, of course, the spider brooch takes off. It's talked about all over the place. And somebody started selling a T-shirt of this spider brooch. It's a black T-shirt with a little spider brooch on it. And it's raised, I think, something like £4,000 for shelter. So it's like one of those odd things where something in the kind of dry world of politics or this dry world of, kind of the news kind of breaks out and it, you know, out into the world of, you know, pop culture and entertainment.
And it's got a song. Go on, sing the song.
Spider brooch. Maybe government, a big approach. That thing just seemed to puncture the endless misery of Brexit. And it just seems quite a joyful thing. So the spider brooch.
It's the new Lady Hale. It's the new Rees-Mogg recline.
Yeah. One thing I thought Boris Johnson and Dom missed is they could have used Bobby Brown's My Prerogative when they'd
it's my,
got the people
is he,
in
it's my problematic.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they could have thought it like, as a meme or something. Yeah.
It's my prerogative.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the end of the show. Thank you from me, Sean, and producer Sophie Black for listening. Patreon people, the extra bit is coming in very shortly where we confess to our youth cult pasts. In the meantime, I'm going to play out with some more mod. Here's Booker T and the MGs with Green Onions. Hannah Verdier, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Michael Hogan, thanks for coming in.
Totes my pleasure.
Sean Patton, and see you next week again for yet more.
Totes my pleasure.
Here we go. Here's Booker T and the MGs. In the meantime, you can take that mail and that Frankie machine and all that other rubbish I have to go out with, and you can stuff them right up your iPhone.